3 years ahead of them in seminary. We both went to Catholic University for our theology. And I was in my fourth year, he was in his first year. So that's when we got to know each other fairly well and became good friends. We didn't see each other that much, but he was a very talented person and had a good heart. He was a real scholar, too.
So, where are you from?
I was born and raised in Dubuque.
Mm-hmm.
My father was from Dubuque. He grew up in Dubuque. And my mother was from Allamakee County, at Waukon, Lansing area. And her family lived on a farm up there. And when she lost her mother when she was about 2 or 3 years old, and she had a full sister, and her father married again, and there were 9 children by that second marriage. And then her father died when she was 20. And so her maternal grandparents, her mother's parents, had farmed near Lansing, and when they retired, they moved to Dubuque. And so they invited my mother and her sister to come and live with them. So that's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's amazing how those things happen. Because they lived 100 miles apart, practically. But the fact that she got to Dubuque I think her father died in 1919. And so she probably moved to Dubuque shortly after that. I don't know what month he died of, but he was in his early 50s. And in those years, they called it heart failure. And then my parents ended up getting married at St. Mary's Church, which is now Steeple Square.
Yep.
And that's where her grandparents went to church. That was kind of the mother church for the German-speaking immigrants. And so that's where they got married. My dad grew up in, I think at a certain point in his life, his family went to Sacred Heart because St. Mary's, the church of St. Mary's, I think, was dedicated in 1867. And there was a great influx of German-speaking immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sacred Heart started up in the late 70s, 1870s. So his family, my dad's family, then ended up going to Sacred Heart. So after my folks got married, they always went to St. Mary's. And we didn't have a car. We didn't own a house. And so we walked wherever we went. You know, but of course we had city buses that took us around somewhat, and so that part was good. And then we went to school at St. Mary's, and that was staffed by Franciscan sisters. And we had no lay teachers at all. I think we had 2 rooms for every grade from first through eighth, and we also had a music teacher. And so the Franciscan sisters had a great impact on us. And my oldest sister, who's 4 years older than me, she'd be this one on top.
Yep.
she just died this past December at the age of 98. But she joined the Franciscans after her junior year of high school.
Wow.
In those years, the Franciscan sisters had a high school for girls. The BVM sisters had a high school for girls. And St. Columbkill's had a high school for boys and girls. You know? And then the Visitation also had a high school for girls. You know, So we, the Franciscans became a very important part of our life, and I'm certainly deeply indebted to them for the impact they had on me, and
mm-hmm.
and so.
So is that kind of what led you to the priesthood then?
Is that kind of a what?
What led you to the priesthood?
I didn't quite catch it.
You're good. Is
my,
that
my hearing is I hear, but I don't pick up certain sounds.
Yeah. Is that kind of what led you to joining the priesthood?
Well, it had a great influence on me. After my parents, the Franciscan sisters had the greatest impact, you know, and you know, of course, the high school that I went to was Lawrence Academy, which was staffed by priests and some lay teachers, and then of course I went to Lawrence for college, and then after that, that was towards the end of the war, and so. The war was over before I had to register for the draft, but that wouldn't have mattered anyway because I was I had my mind made up pretty much, you know, I was very attracted to it, been very happy with it.
Good.
I celebrated my 70th anniversary a year ago, so that's a long time.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, and so I spent. Well, the first year I was ordained, I was at New Vienna. That's close to where
mm-hmm.
you live. And I was there a year. And at that time, a lot of the parishes had high schools. They were small high schools. And so a lot of those parishes, at that time, we had an abundance of priests. And so a lot of parishes like Farley and Dyersville, I think, had three priests. Farley had two. New Vienna had two. Worthington had two. And a number of other. Holy Cross had one. But basically, my need what I did when I was at New Vienna was teach in high school. I taught Latin and religion, was the coach, you know. So I was there just a year, and then I got appointed to Loris, so I taught at Loris Academy
mm-hmm.
for 4 years. And then I became the dean of students. We called dean of men in those years because we had no women.
Yep.
Students. So we didn't use the term dean of students. So I was there from 56 until 69.
Yes, and that would have been in your 40s, right?
In my 40s?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I was ordained when I was going on 24. So I was, to a great extent in my 30s.
Okay.
I left Loris when I was 41.
Okay.
And I was the dean of students for 13 years.
Yeah.
So it was, I never thought of being a college faculty member, but it was a wonderful assignment for me, actually. Because in those years we had, I think in the 60s, we had something like 45 priests on the faculty. And most of the departments had a priest who had a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very well staffed. And of course, then in the '50s and '60s, the college became much bigger, and so many of the teachers then that came in were lay people, lay men for the most part, but some women,
mm-hmm.
and so I was there, and of course as the dean of students, in those years, we didn't have many buildings. We had Kane Hall, and we had 300 students living in that building. And that was one of my duties, to supervise that residence hall. And I think the first year I had two priests as my assistants who had PhDs. I didn't even have an MA at that time. And so, but you know, with a well-educated priest faculty, we of course we had our meals together, and that was really a wonderful opportunity to get to know people that were very well educated, and the spirit there was good. And so,
so what did your relationship to like students look like?
What does it look like? What did it look like?
Yeah.
Well, in my first years, the first 4 or 5 years, I had two assistants who helped, and so we would do room check every night except Saturday. Maybe Friday and Saturday, and so. But then, after a couple of years, we began to have what we at that time we called them hall counselors, which is they are comparable to what is a resident assistant now. And so we had two students on, and we had four floors with students: second, third, fourth, and fifth. And so then we had two upper-class students who were resident assistants on each of those floors. And so that I think that began in 59, after I was there about 3 years. And so I had less contact with them after that, because the resident assistants, you know, I took a room check a good part of the time, and I rarely got involved with, you know, any discipline issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got at Smith Hall, we had, I think, 40 or 50 students. And what was St. Joseph's Hall at that time, had about 60 that were resident on campus. And then I think Roman Hall was the building for seminary students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was built and opened up about 52 or so, shortly before I got there. And then the rest were city students or day students. And we had, you know, a lot of students from out of the town who lived off campus in homes that were rented out to them by the people that owned the homes and mm-hmm. so on. So I got to, I was very concerned, first of all, to know the students by name. And so whenever I would, you know, I would, before the students enrolled, they were to provide us with a couple of facial pictures. Well, that was very helpful, you know. So sometimes when I would meet them for the first time on opening day, you know, especially if they had siblings that had been there before them, I'd call them by name. Mm-hmm. Well, that word got around. But then when I walk across the campus, that whenever I came across a student, if I knew his first name, I'd call him that. Hello, John, or hello, Kate. And that was pretty good.
Yeah.
And when I was appointed to be the dean of men, I was at summer school that particular summer. That would have been the summer of 56. And I got a letter from the archbishop. Now, usually that appointment was made by the president, but in that particular era, the archbishop was making these appointments. Of course, the president would indicate what he wanted. excuse me. So, lost my train of thought. Let me. I was at summer school and I got this letter from the archbishop, and he said in the letter, "I'm thinking about appointing you to be the dean of men at Lawrence College. Is there any reason why you couldn't do that?" And so I thought about it for a couple of days and then wrote back and said, oh, I think I could do that. And of course, being tall, as you've realized, you know, when I was at the academy, you know, the second year I was there, I became the assistant principal, and I dealt pretty much with the discipline of the students, you know, besides teaching three or four courses. And just a minute, I'm going to get a throat lodgings.
Sure.
So my voice holds up. Turn was to be fair and to the students and respect them. And that was fairly easy for me to do because my parents were very respectful people. And and they treated us, I had four siblings, and they were concerned that they'd be fair and dealing with us and so on. We were different, all different, but and they did that. We had wonderful harmony in our family. Excuse me. So I think I had the respect of the students generally. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't have any contact with black students when I was growing up, what it would happen when I was a kid growing up, the understanding that we had was that if a black person came into the city and would be more like a vagrant or looking for something to eat or something like that, the police would we had the understanding the police would say, well, you could keep moving, otherwise you'd get in trouble here. See, so it was a very hostile place for black students. And we had one black person in town, as I know it, and he was a podiatrist. My mother had foot problems, and so she went to him. But he was highly respected because he was professional and well-educated, and good person. You know. So getting back to your question, what was my attitude towards the students? Well, I wanted to treat them respectfully, justly, and trust them, you know. And I think I had that respect, you know. So then in the late 60s, I think we had, well, if you can get some sense of what was happening in the 60s with regard to people of color, you have some idea of what the black students were dealing with. Mm-hmm. Because Martin Luther King had made race a big issue. There was, you know, especially in the South, but also in the North. For example, one of the students of color said he lived in Cedar Rapids with his family, and he would say that, you know, they had relatives in Chicago, when they would go from Cedar Rapids to Chicago, they had no place where they could stop for a restroom break. You know, they had to provide something along the way to take care of that, you know. And they had to carry food with them because, you know, even in the Midwest, which was probably not as scarred with racism as the South, but that was the situation. But one of the things that was happening that was because of the mood in the 60s, I think was in 64, We had the Civil Rights Act, you know, in those years, you know, in a lot of the restaurants they wouldn't serve people of color, but that sort of thing. And they rode on the bus, they had to sit in the back seats. And then in the, I think in 65, then we had the Voting Rights Act, which was very significant. So that made a difference. And I think what was especially significant was that young people of color were beginning to embrace their color, you know. And they would embrace their color, and they would, you know, with it. We were hesitant in those years to call a person a black person or a brown person, but they would embrace that, you know. And I remember in Kane Hall, where we had some of the black students in residence, one of the students had a sign on the door, black is beautiful. To be beautiful is to be black. Yeah. And we had a lot of Chicago area students. And some of them got really steamed up about that. So another thing was that they became, they had a better sense of who they were. An unusual example is one of the students, his name was Joseph Bennett. He wanted to be called Joseph. He said, people that were brought up in slavery, they had family names that were those of their master or their slave owner, mm-hmm. you know. And so he wouldn't use his last name. But we also had several black athletes that were quite good, and some of the black students we had were really leaders and they were very bright people, so they were somewhat assertive of their rights as persons and so on, and that was wonderful, but. But a lot of white people really got in, what should I say, you know, they bothered them, you know. They didn't expect that. And of course, we had a lot of white students that didn't treat them very well. Usually on campus, they were okay. But they would tell me, you know, when I talked to them privately, you know, they go downtown to buy something or go someplace, they'd be called nigger, that sort of thing. And one of them mentioned that he was coming back from being downtown and he ran into a group of three or four white kids and they started to chase him and he ran all the way back to the campus. You know, he didn't know what to expect. But I was, you know, not having had any contact with black students or brown students, my seventh grade teacher, of course, was a Franciscan, as I mentioned. But before I had her as a teacher, for several years, I don't know just how many, she had taught in Chicago at Corpus Christi, which was a black Catholic school. And so one of the things she did along the way in our seventh grade year, in those years we used to have a composite showing the faces of the students, you know, get them all on one sheet. And she had something similar, you know, for the students she had in Chicago. So she had us pair off with one of the students there. It can be kind of like pen pals. Well, I imagine we had a few exchanges, you know, with letters and notes and that sort of thing. But she was a very positive influence. And But I think for me, it was very rare for my parents, either parent, to put people down. They just didn't do that. They might talk about shortcomings of this or that relative, but they never talked down to him, as far as I could tell. So as a result, having grown up in that kind of a home, my siblings were, we all were pretty much in the same mindset and that sort of thing. That was very helpful because, even though I didn't know black people, I respected them. And I think that was very important. Because in 68 and the first part of 69, when I was dealing with black and or brown students, I trusted them, and they trusted me. And in fact, I didn't realize the impact I had on them. One of the black graduates of 69 said, I wouldn't have been at war if you hadn't been there, you know. And, I don't know, you probably have heard about this. One of the things that happened was that one of the black students, who was a real leader, came to me in the spring of 68. And he said, would it be possible for the black students to live on fourth floor and have white students who are interested come and join us? And I asked them for their reasons. And I don't recall exactly what they told me, but I think it was pretty much they have their own space, you know, and have a place where they were very comfortable with each other. And so I said, oh, that'd be okay. And of course, I let the president know. So one of the things I have here is a booklet probably, I'll give it to you and you can take it with you when you go, as long as you bring it back to me.
Sure.
But it gets into I left Forest in 69,
mm-hmm.
And some of the black and white students that were together, the white students were Students for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
That was during the run up to the Vietnam War, and. So that group came to town, I think it was the same weekend as homecoming, and they had a gathering downtown at the Redstone House. It's right by the, you know where that is? Yeah, it's right by the post office.
Okay.
And so I thought, didn't make anything special of it because they had invited a couple other faculty members. I think Father Wilkie might have been there, Father Ede. So after I went around and greeted everybody and got reacquainted, Greg Rhodes, who was really the leader in many ways, he got, there's some issues about him in that collection of clippings and so on, from either clippings from the Lorien school paper or the Dubuque paper. And so Greg kind of, took command of the situation then he he started to talk about me. And which kind of surprised me, And so as a result, they, then after we got done talking and being very, very positive about my presence and their association with me in 68 and 69 especially. And they gave me that plaque, which is right behind you. I don't have it, copies of it. But well, it really surprised me because it, you know, I assumed they, well, I knew they trusted me, you know, because of the way they acted towards me and so on. And so that was, what's the date on that? 13th? 23rd? At the bottom there? 20,
yep, 2013.
2013?
Yep.
Okay. So that was, let's see, 41 and 13. That would be 54 years after Isle of Flores, mm-hmm. You know. No, 44 maybe, yeah. So that was one of the things that I was really gratified by, of course.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the last things in that booklet, or whatever you call that,
mm-hmm.
Clippings and so on, is an article about me leaving Lourdes. I don't know if you heard about that or
mm-hmm.
not. Oh, yeah. Okay. And so that surprised me. But anyway, you can read those articles and I'll give you if maybe enlighten you on some of the things that transpired.
Do you mind if I look?
No.
I've looked through a bunch of TH articles.
Yeah.
So I have read quite a bit, but I'm curious what you have here.
Well, the first page are the students, black and white. And the white students who were very favorable with the blacks were the Students for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then the black students were the Black Student Union. See, those are the names they used. And of course, that's mentioned in the plaque. But I think in January of 68, maybe, we were having some friction among students. And
mm-hmm.
We had in those years, what is now, I think, of the business office on first floor of Kane Hall. That was the kind of like a student lounge or student reading room. I remember we gathered there and they heard those things out. But I think, too, with that change in attitude towards black students, or they were being empowered, and that was very important for them, and I think of course the white students, they had no clue as to what the black kids were experiencing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had some sense of it because I think in the middle of the 60s I read an article by our Jesuit who was teaching at the Jesuit College down in New Orleans. And he said, "Now, if you really want to get familiar with the race situation, here are some books to read." So I read some of those. So I had somewhat of a feel for it, you know. So it was a very significant time, and of course I was having been at Lourdes as the dean of students for 13 years, I was thinking, well, you know, I had a hard time staying awake at night, and on weekends especially, I would usually prowl around and be around. The students would be coming in late, and some of them weren't always in the best of condition, and so the students were aware of the fact that I'd be around. would be very helpful. And but I remember one occasion I just couldn't stay awake, so I went to bed about 11 o'clock. Well, I used to stay up until about 1 on Friday night or Saturday night, whichever. Usually Friday night would be the big one, but so it was something. So I think, well, you know, my intention was to be a parish priest. I never thought about teaching at Lourdes or teaching in high school, but I enjoyed that. You know, I must say it was a good time in my life, as my other assignments have been. And so to have to leave at that point, I had mixed emotions, you know.
This is awesome. Yeah. I've found a lot of these articles and I've read them, but a lot of them are new too, and that's really exciting.
Well, they gave me this group, you know, at 2013. Mm-hmm. They gave me that.
Yeah.
They had collected them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And,
yeah. Wow.
And then when the president Jim Collins told me that the students had asked to honor me by a bust in some way, and that was a surprise. And but I enjoyed it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And,
yeah.
And I think at the end of that, I have the epigraph of the bust there, which mm-hmm. is up at Lourdes.
And, yep.
And, so, but it was a very, what should I say, very gratifying experience, obviously, you know,
yeah.
And the fact that it happened so many years later, one of the black alumni of Lourdes made the comment. He said, I think he and a couple of other blacks had a lot to do with it. And he said, we wanted to be sure that you knew that we appreciated you. Oh, that's beautiful.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And
do you remember the name Thomas Jackson?
Give that again.
Thomas Jackson?
Thomas Jackson, yeah, he was a good basketball player.
I was able to reach out to him, so I'll be interviewing him too.
Well, you will, okay.
I will, yeah.
I don't know if he lived in Cane Hall or if he lived in Beckman Hall.
I think he was in Cane. Huh? I'm not sure, but I think he was in Cane.
He was where?
In Cane. On the fourth floor of Cane.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
You're good.
And, yeah, so he was a big person on campus physically and, of course, mm-hmm. an excellent basketball player.
Yeah.
And, so give him my greetings. And, but I know George Wilson was another one who was very, very much involved. Mm-hmm. And so after Lourdes established their chair for one of the issues I deal with in a stage of my life is I reach for words or or concepts, and mm-hmm. you know, my head doesn't work as well as it used to. Well, it never probably was great anyway, but it's anyway, was diversity, equity, and what's the third term? Inclusiveness. And Laura set up a special program for that. And then they hired he is an alumnus, but anyway, he's a brown person, mm-hmm. you know. And so they, I think after he joined the faculty, as a part of emphasizing diversity, equity, and inclusiveness, they wanted to celebrate that. And so they celebrated by inviting George Wilson back to give a presentation. And he was concerned that I'd be there, and so I was there. And I didn't appreciate a lot of stuff until later on, but he's a, I think, a university professor down in the Carolinas someplace, So that was very, very gratifying as well.
There's an article in there about you. It says, I think, Kutch fired from Loras. Could you kind of feel tensions rising to when that happened, or did it feel sudden?
Well, our president was Monsignor Driscoll, and he had been appointed to be the president of Loras in 67, and so he wasn't that much older than me. But I knew that we didn't think alike on things, and I think he was a person who, well, he wanted things to go the way he thought they should go, And I remember the athletic coming in one day to my office, which is right across from the president's office. At that time, it was right inside the main entrance, and he had this facial hair policy. So he gave me a copy of it, and then he was on his way to give a copy of it to Monsignor Driscoll. And so following that, I sent a note to the president saying, I don't think that's good. Facial hair is somewhat a cultural thing. And one of the articles in there is that Greg Rose, who had a goatee and so on, that's the way he wanted to live, and he well groomed and all that, but he quit the basketball team, or I don't know if he quit or if they say he couldn't play because he continued to have his goatee, but I of course I having had 12, 13 years experience dealing with college age students is a little bit different than. See, Monsignor Driscoll was in charge of education throughout the Archdiocese. And so he was dealing generally with religious sisters and lay men and women, who were teaching in our schools, in our Catholic schools. And that's one kind of environment. And of course, at Loras, we had faculty who would speak up about things, we weren't lap dogs, so that I was aware of the fact that he wasn't always excited about the decisions I made, and I think one of the things on my side of it was that when I became the dean of men at Loras. I didn't have any job description, and I didn't have any mentoring. Now, at the time I became the dean of men in August of 56, Laura Slane was the president, I was in many ways his appointment, Well, in September, he got I think he was an auxiliary bishop at the time, if I'm not mistaken. But in September, he got appointed to be the bishop of Rockford. So he left, after about a month, So if he had stayed around, I thought I probably would have had a much better feel for things because he was kind of the mentoring type and that sort of thing. But you kind of found your way, you stumbled along and got by that way. And so one of the things I remember early on, we had a discipline committee that was made up of about 7 or 8 faculty members. And so when I became the dean of students, I would call the meetings of that committee. If a student had done something which might merit suspension or expulsion, which is wonderful tradition they had, because it wasn't, you didn't need a faculty member or a personnel person, making such drastic decisions. And so that was really good. And so the judgments that they made were great. Well, in those days, one of the priests on that committee was the secretary, and then he would type up the minutes of the meeting, and there'd be they'd use carbon copies in those days. It was a long way from what we do today. And well, if he was prompt, then I'd just send that copy over to the president, and that was it. Or rather than going over and talking to him. But I didn't have a sense of doing that. Well, one day, I think probably in my, see, then Monsignor Foley became the president. I think he became the president in November of that fall. And I think either that first year or the, yeah, probably that first year, we had expelled a student for bringing beer into Kane Hall, and he hadn't got a copy of the minutes about that meeting. And so the father of this kid walks into his office, and he was blindsided. And so, and I thought, I should have known better, but I didn't. No, and the thing is, young and inexperienced, there are a lot of things you don't do. But if you have a person who's been around a little bit and has a good feel for things, and say, "Oh yeah, that's something. Be sure to keep them informed." If someone would have mentioned me, well, be sure you keep the president informed about everything. Made a difference. So, by the time Monsignor Driscoll came along, I had learned that lesson, so I kept him informed somewhat. But I was, the students had been rather aggressive, and I think you'll see that in one or two articles there. They were being very assertive, and these were black and white students. And we had I think in those years we had a noon mass at Christ King Chapel. And I think this was Ascension Thursday, that it was a holy day of obligation. And so they, a number of them, marched into the sanctuary. I don't know if there's a picture in there of that or not.
I remember reading.
I
I've
don't
read
see
about this one.
it.
Yeah.
and so, well, I didn't get too excited about that. I just said, well, when they asked me, well, I said, well, we'll be discussing it at our next discipline committee meeting. Excuse me. Might need to get a drink here. There are some limitations to aging, as you can see. Want something to drink?
I'm okay. I've got some water here.
Okay.
Yep.
Great. Life, one of the problems I have at this stage is I use my voice very much. I end up doing what I've been doing, coughing and so on. I was able to preside and preach at Mass until I was over 90, so I was, very blessed in that regard. Yeah. excuse me. Well, one of the things I think that stuck in Monsignor Driscoll's claw was we had a speaker that came to campus, and it was for the students and so on, and we had a the students were given a check card which they were to hand in. We made sure that they went to it, and well, this was, I think, in March of that spring, students called a strike. One of the issues was that the students would, through the student government, whatever the term was, student senate, they would make recommendations about rules. And when I became the dean of men in 56, we were treating lay students pretty much like seminarians, you know. And so great that we, having those resident assistants, you know, that was very important. And being more, less sticky about, you know, some things. But the students would come out every year with recommendations, and then often I would check with the other resident hall personnel about the recommendations and so on, and then I would say, well, this is what we're going to do. And we had a student handbook, they probably still had that. And but anyway, the students had given me their request, and I sent them over to the president, and well, he didn't respond to them very quickly. And then one of them went in to his office one day, and he said, well, we already decided that. He never told me that he had. And and so, you know, students were aware that that process wasn't working like it should, you know. And but at that time, the priests of the archdiocese had their own priest council. That was rather new. It came up, developed after Vatican II. And so he wanted me to, I was very much interested in that priest senate. And so I decided to go. And he didn't want me to go because he was afraid that students wouldn't be under control. That's right. I don't. And so I think that he didn't like that. I thought, well, whatever his disappointment in that was, look at the bigger picture, you know. And, so I was surprised, but not completely. But I think, you know, there are some people that when they get into positions of authority, what should I say, they have a need to be able to make the decisions, you know, and determine what's going to happen. Well, in a college faculty, a lot of issues that needed to be discussed by faculty committees and so on, and then you get feedback, and that's given to the president, and eventually, you know, it was that sort of thing. So,
do you remember kind of what you were feeling when you were moved?
Yeah, I was. I had mixed emotions, you know. I think the abruptness of it bothered me, you know. And I really felt that I hadn't been treated too well. But I also was aware of the fact that, well, you know, at that stage of my life, I was 40 years old, 41 years old, and you have a good feel for what happened, and you know that some of the people that have gone before you didn't always get what they would prefer, and that sort of thing, and so. So I tried to deal with it as best I could, and so I ended up at this small parish of Fayette, Iowa, that had 5 or 10 families, and had a little mission of Hawkeye, which was about 15 miles away, and it had 25 families, my goal, when I went to the seminary, was to become a parish priest, and so I thought, well, that would work better for me than being a college teacher, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I taught a math class in my first years on the college faculty, which is 1 hour every day, 5 day course, or five hour course.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Vatican Council was beginning to crank up, which began in 1962. Once I went to the seminary, I was no longer interested in math as a priority, which was my college major. But I had a great love for liturgy and for social action and that sort of thing. I think this probably was in January, maybe, of 61, could have been, 62. I went to Father Friedman, who was the academic dean, and I said, this is what I would like to do. I'd like to teach a course on church and sacraments.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great love for me. And Father Friedman had known him. I was a good friend of his. And he was he taught me second year Latin, I think, or third year Latin at Loris Academy. He had a doctorate in German at that particular time. When the war was going on, there were hardly any college students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to him, if you give me the go ahead, I'll start to, this was in, I think, January, February, somewhere there. I said, if you give me the go-ahead, I'll start preparing for that, and I'll be ready in September to present this course. And he said, okay, go ahead. And at that time, the religion department at Loris wasn't good. They were they were beginning to be concerned about it, and I think we had two or three priests that were away getting theology degrees, which was a hopeful sign.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a 2-hour course, and I had 2 sections, and I enjoyed those very much. That was my love, I think that was the religion requirement for either sophomores or juniors, I thought the course went over fairly well, and it was wonderful in many ways. And of course, then when Vatican II came along, there was a lot of ferment in the church, and that was good.
Yeah.
When that pre-Senate meeting came up, I mentioned to the president I was going to go to it, and then he indicated to me that he wanted me to stay there. I pretend I didn't hear that. No. That could probably be his main issue. But yeah, it's been a good life. I had my ups and downs occasionally, but being a priest and being a faculty member and being a pastor, I've been very fulfilling for me. I think I've done reasonably well in carrying out those roles. So,
I would say so.
yeah. So, it's been a good life, and one of the things I was concerned about, having grown up in Dubuque, and my family was ill. And I think, but my dad had died in October of 68. And he had a brain tumor. He was operated on in Iowa City, and that gave him a little more time. But because of the tumor, they were limited what they could do. And but my mother was there, and my brother and his family were there. I had a younger sister who lived out on the other side of not Key West, but Asbury. She married a farmer. She had a large family. And of course, my sister was a Franciscan. She taught in several Iowa schools over the years, and then eventually taught in Hazel Crest and Midlothian, Illinois, two suburbs of Chicago. And of course, I knew a lot of friends, knew a lot of Franciscans and so on. And so, when it happens in your own hometown, I was concerned. But my mother, God bless her, there was a lot of reaction to my being fired. And there were various protests made about it, and from faculty and alumni and other people. And well, several months later, well, then this happened at the end of May, I believe it was, or the first week of June. And then I moved on to Fayette in July. And I think about the time I left in July, or maybe it might have been even after that, my mother gave me a scrapbook with all these clippings about the protests made in my being fired, so to speak. That little mother, and so I was very pleased because I knew that she was taking it okay, and so it was one of those special memories of my parents. So, I've been greatly blessed by my parents, but they only had eighth grade education, but they're simple people. Good. None of us, none of us siblings had any doubt that our parents loved us and cared about us and would do whatever we needed and all that. It was just wonderful. So over the years, as a parish priest, I got to know a lot of families, and some of them weren't doing too well. See, how I was blessed. I was able to observe my siblings raise their families, and they're very good in a lot of ways. I'm sure they weren't perfect, but So, well, anyway, that's where it is.
So after leaving Loras, did you maintain any of those relationships or connections to students or faculty?
Give that again.
After leaving Loras, did you still have relationships with faculty or students?
Well, I had some, not greatly, but no. In those years, we had a lot of young priests on the faculty, and priests like Father Wilkie and Father Ede and Father Collins and a couple other ones. They were good friends of mine. And of course, I kept in touch with them and would occasionally go back. And some of the lay faculty I knew quite well, like Dr. Augie, Tom Augie. That'd be his son.
Yep.
He was, we were mutual admirers of each other. And Bud Noonan was the registrar, and we worked a lot together. And that was good. I, you know, would occasionally get back to and of course, most of them I had good relationships with. And of course, we would have periodic gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of them is the Chrism Mass, which we're going to have on Tuesday. And time for us to get together with the other priests of the diocese, some that you don't see very often. And then there would be, well, there are other occasions where we're together. So. What are you going to do with all of this? Write something up?
I hope to.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, I commend you for being interested in,
yeah,
in that history, you know? And it's, I think the, you know, one of the deep concerns I and other, some other priests have is the fact that as a church, we haven't dealt with the race situation very well.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly at all,
yeah.
You know? And, and there are a few of us that have stood out because we have spoken up about it in various ways. And it's too bad, but those are things that, that we need to, within our own priest community, to agitate for something better, you know. Excuse me. So, but I have a deep interest in social action and the Church of Social Teaching, and I think over the years I have periodically sent letters to the editor at the Telegraph Herald, and they only allow you to do one a month at most, but I haven't done that recently. But mm-hmm. if something comes up that I'm stirred up about, I'll send it in, but. But that's been a good witness too, you know, that having, I was at, you know, I left Lawrence in 69, and I was at Fayette for 2 years, and then I volunteered for team ministry in Waterloo, and I was there from 71 to 76, during that time, I was a member of the Priest Personnel Board, which was it was an honor and a challenge. And then in 76, I was appointed to St. Jude's in Cedar Rapids, and I was there 11 years. And then in 87, I was appointed to St. Anthony's. I was there 12 years, and then I retired. So I had, St. Jude's was the team ministry was very good. We had, the priest had asked the archbishop to establish some team ministries. And so they decided to have one that would involve one of the parishes in Waterloo and the parish at Evansdale, which is right outside of Waterloo. And so, they indicated anyone who was interested to send a letter in and indicate that. Well, six of us volunteered for that, and four of the six were appointed to it. And that was a very rich experience for me because it helped me to have a better sense of what it means to be a parish priest, you know, after years of teaching and and student personnel work. And then when I got to St. Jude's, that was a, at that time, that was the youngest parish in the diocese. And it was a wonderful experience too. And, part of Cedar Rapids, there are a lot of people that would move into Cedar Rapids from small towns, or they were, you know, in the employment that they had really wasn't what they wanted, and so they were on their way up, and they were very good at organizing, and so it was very gratifying to work with those people, you know. And then St. Anthony's was just it's the most unusual parish, you know. It's had a wonderful history, and they used to, I think the last couple of years, they may not have had this weekend, but they had what they called an Emmaus weekend. And so what had happened in the 60s, Curcio, did you ever hear of Curcio? It was a program started, I think, in Spain, and I eventually came to this country, but it was a renewal experience, spiritual renewal experience. And so a number of priests got involved with that, and they got lay people involved. And it would start on a Thursday evening, and it would go through all day Friday, all day Saturday, and close on Sunday evening. Well, that's a big commitment for anyone. And well, then it was going over quite well. But then they realized that the leaders of the of that effort didn't have much depth and for the kind of formation they should have. So the leadership of that group, which were priests and lay people, decided, well, let's call a moratorium on these weekends. So they did. Well, that moratorium went on for a number of years, and nothing seemed to be happening, and so several different groups of people decided to have a condensed version of that. And St. Anthony's people were one of those. Mm-hmm. And so this was in the 70s. So they got together, the core group of them that got together had made the Curcio, and they saw the value of it. And so they developed a program which would start on a Friday evening, go through Saturday and Sunday until Sunday afternoon. And so they organized it. They prepared the schedule and the content of the talks and the dynamics that were involved in the weekend. And I think they had the benefit of a couple of nuns who lived very close to St. Anthony's, who were Franciscans. One of them was a theologian. And so they started to have those weekends in 1979. And they would have one for the men and one for the women. And so I think in the early years, I think that, 1 year they had two of each. But then when I got there in 87, they were having them. And what was so beautiful about it was that the lay people organized it, and they were in charge. And early on, when I got to St. Anthony's, the lady who was going to be head of the Women's Weekend came to me and told me about it, and said, "We want you to be there." And I said, "Okay, I'll be there." And I think at one point, maybe around 1890 or 1990 or a little bit later, some of the people involved in that said, "Well, there have been something like 800 people in the parish that have made that weekend, you know." And so the spiritual depth of that parish were wonderful, you know, just. And we had a, at that time, when I went there, we had the largest Catholic school in Dubuque. And the you know, the tradition of the parish had developed over the years, and a number of the teachers in the school were musicians, and it was just wonderful, you know. And it was just, it was really unbelievable in many ways. And then after we were there, I was there a year or two, we adopted a mission parish in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, I think, the first 6 or 7 years, we sent money to the parish a couple times a year. We have a special collection. Well, this 1 year, I think it was about 95, our parish council was dealing with a program that was set up by the Bishop's Conference in Washington. And the gist of the program was that the parish should develop an outreach to people within the parish who are kind of isolated. But they, and then the second part of it is, an equally important part, reaching out to people beyond the parish. And well, at that time, we had this relationship with the parish, but it was just monetary.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that first year, it was 96, we had a group of parishioners that went down and spent a week in that parish. And then a short time after that, the pastor and one of his parishioners came up to St. Anthony's. So it's been going ever since. And it's tremendous what they've done. You know?
Yeah, it's awesome.
And it's, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. I've been doing all the talk.
Well, what do you want to know?
Well, what's the makeup of your family, first of all?
Sure. So my mom and my dad. And then I have two older brothers and an older sister and then one little sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's similar to my family. I have one brother and three sisters.
Mm-hmm.
You have two brothers and two sisters,
yes.
Huh?
And then my grandparents on my dad's side, they live in Centralia, so super close to us. They'll be married. Well, they've been married for 73 years.
Uh-huh.
So, yep. I think my grandfather is 99.
He is.
Yeah.
Longevity.
He's doing well.
That's so good. That's amazing.
Yep. And
I've been blessed in that regard, too. My mother died at 95.
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, her mother died at 31. Her father died at 51 or 52. You know, so, but, and on my dad's side, he had seven siblings. Well, six of his seven siblings got to be 87 and beyond. You know, and, so, but that's a special gift, you know.
Yeah.
You get better with age in some ways. So, but, so.
Yeah.
Were you the first one to go to college or not?
My oldest brother and my older sister have as well.
Yeah, they went to college.
Yeah, but my parents didn't.
Yeah.
So. But yeah. That's,
yeah, that's amazing. See, my parents had just had an eighth grade education, but you know, all of my siblings went through high school. And I have a sister who dropped out in her sophomore year. She had been sick as a kid, and so it's a little bit behind. But I was the first one to go to college. My extended family, there were a couple that had gone earlier, but hardly anyone. And after World War II, a lot of, some of my cousins that came back from service, the GI Bill was available, and so a number of them went to college, got degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your ambition?
Well, I don't know. I love social justice. I love interfaith stuff. I find it super interesting. I don't know. I grew up, being told that all life is precious, and I don't know. Life matters a lot to me. And that goes beyond, the typical pro-life issues what a lot of people would consider.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just...
Well, that's great. Wonderful. Yeah.
I hope that whatever I do, I can just help people.
Yeah.
That's all I really care about.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I was quite interested in that. I was hoping that I might have a niece or a nephew that got interested in church related things, then I got a note. One of my grandnieces, who just started UNI last fall, I had, in talking with her dad on one occasion, I got the impression that she was very much interested in being a lay missionary.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, that's wonderful. And turns out that, do you ever hear of Focus? Do you have Focus people?
Yep.
At Morris, you do,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And she got interested in Focus. And she's only a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And what's unusual about her in a way is she's a very good basketball player. Now, she's not all that big, but she played 4 years on the varsity team at Wallert. Mm-hmm. So she was pretty good. I never saw her play, but but my brother, of course, saw her a lot. And but her dad mentioned one time, I made some comment about it. He has one son and three daughters. Maybe his son Nick would go to Haiti and spend a little time there. And he said, "Well, no, that probably wouldn't. But Allie, the youngest one that I'm talking about, she would." I got a note from her not too long ago, and she had signed up for this Focus training program. And she's indicated in that that they have, I don't know, 8 or 10 students who have some interest in Focus. And then one of the priests and one of the trained Focus people, they would be going on a week's program in New Mexico someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, part of their commitment is to raise a couple $1,000 to take care of their expenses. And so she sent me one of these begging letters, which I was happy to respond to. And so she's going to get involved with that.
That's awesome.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And she wrote me a note, when she asked me for a contribution. It was very obvious she was very excited about it, so that was great to hear that.
Yeah.
So surprises.
Yeah.
But it's a very gratifying life, and of course it has its challenges, but I think one of the things it does, it It really broadens our vision, you know, what we should be about. And we have a lot of wonderful people that do very good things, but their primary focus is on making money, you know. And of course, sometimes they do things beyond that, but it only always makes the impact on people that is of added meaning. So, well, it's been a very good to be with you. And,
I appreciate this a lot.
oh,
It's been
good.
awesome.
Glad to have the opportunity.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm glad Father Beck was able to check
yeah.
with you. Make sure
Yeah,
you
well, we,
want to talk.
you know, I know him well, and
Yeah.
he's done a lot of wonderful things.
Yeah, I here's his book.
Yeah, okay.
I just helped him publish a book of his poetry, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's made a great, great impact.
I've gotten to know him pretty well
Good.
while at Loris. Yeah. Yeah, he's amazing for sure.
Yeah, he's got a great interest in it. I was over there one day, last year, I guess it was, when I picked up that book. One of my friends, who's a great advocate of his, who was my DRE, Director of Religious Education, when I was in Cedar Rapids, and she wanted to go, and so I went with her, and he gave this talk, and I had a chance to get a hold of one of those books, and so I bought it. So, well, good. I wish you well, and
Thank
if I
you.
can help you further, let me know.
We will do.